given that name because of its proximity to what the white people call Devil's Lake State Park, but the Ho-Chunk people call that Dewakanchunk, which means Sacred Lake or Spirit Lake. And this entire area, including the park and the lake and this area that was historically prairie, and west of here there's Natural Bridge Park, all of that is part of a huge cultural district that the Ho-Chunk Nation recognizes. So these are all areas that historically the Ho-Chunk Nation inhabited. They use these areas for everything they typically would use areas for, you know, to live, to survive, to gather medicine, to gather food, to, you know, have cultural ceremonies out here. For example, there's dance rings up on the hill here, not too far away, which is actually in the state park part of the property. There's pipestone quarries not too far up the bluff that are just off the Ho-Chunk Nation land here, so areas where they gathered materials for their sacred pipes that they used in ceremonial. This land here is part of the last land cession of the federal government, so that's happened in 1837, and that was, they say it was 3.7 million acres was the last land cession, and they call that the Royce Cession of 245. Prior to that, if you look at the treaties, the Ho-Chunk Nation would have been said to have up to like 10.5 million acres in their Aboriginal lands. That 10.5 million would have been, there would have been overlap with other tribes in Wisconsin. So, I mean, the thing is with Ho-Chunk and all the other Native American tribes, there's no sense of land ownership back then. I mean, it's different now with modern times where people have deeds to property. But back then, you know, tribes were nomadic. They moved around to get the resources they needed to survive or to do different things. And so, you know, there was really no ownership. But this is all part of that last land cession that happened in 1837. From 1837 to 1881 would have been the forest Indian removal period. So Ho-Chunk Nation was forced out of Wisconsin onto, I think there were 8 makeshift reservations set up in different areas. Some of them were in Minnesota, Iowa, and Nebraska. And actually, some of you may have heard of the Nebraska Winnebago tribe. That's actually, they're all related to the Ho-Chunk people. The Ho-Chunk tribe that I work for now actually used to be called the Wisconsin Winnebago, and then they changed their name to what it's supposed to be as Ho-Chunk. So the Nebraska Winnebago, same, all relations, but it's a separate recognized federal tribe. Let's see, so the Indian removals, that happened up until 1881, and then the allotment legislation passed, and that allowed individual tribal members and families to, you know, they were essentially granted parcels of land to live on. But all through that process, when the Ho-Chunk people were getting forced onto these makeshift reservations, they didn't want to be there, of course. They wanted to be in their homeland. So they would always, there was always a large percentage of people that would literally walk back from Minnesota or Nebraska, and they'd come back to the area where they wanted to be. So they never really, the federal government was never successful in removing the Ho-Chunk people from this area, so they've always had strong ties to this place. Are there any questions so far? No? Okay, I'll just keep going on then.
You're doing great.
Yeah, so after the allotment legislation, I'll kind of step forward. So the Ho-Chunk people are here on the land, and then basically the white settlers started coming in, and they were, you know, forced off the land. Those white settlers started to farm this area, you know, pretty much would use the open areas, this flat area, for their grass crops like barley, wheat. You know, they didn't grow corn and soybeans back then like they do now, and just, you know, subsistence farming, small farms. And then the hills are typically used for pasture areas because they couldn't grow their wheat or their basically did adverse possession on those farmers, paid them what they called fair market value, and took the land to build this ammunition plant. That ammunition plant, so the entire Badger parcel is something like almost 8,000 acres. The whole chunk portion that we're on right now is 1,552 acres. But the original plant was supposed to be like 10,000 acres, but they scaled back to 8,000 because they didn't need all the land. But, so the Army came in, built the ammunition plant, and basically about a year and a half's time, they started producing the powder that they needed to support the war effort. And they had as many as 12,000 people working out here at one time to try and get this ammunition plant built. And then when it was in operation, they'd have anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 people working out here. And it operated for World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And then after the Vietnam War, they tried to keep it in standby status where they could flip the switch and actually start producing powder again if they needed to. But at some point, the federal government decided they didn't need to maintain this property, and that was declared excess or surplus federal land in 1987. In 87, and you guys were at the Kickapoo yesterday, so I'll kind of tie it back to that. So in 87, when this was declared excess land, there's a federal statute that allows Native American tribes to come in and reclaim that land. So the tribe was just getting done with that process in the Kickapoo, where they got back 1,200 acres. They put in a request for actually the entire 8,000 acres here to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That was reviewed by the agency. The agency, you know, understandingly was not real comfortable with that large amount of acreage because there was a lot of environmental liabilities associated with this place. You know, they made explosives out here. They used a lot of compounds to make those explosives that are contaminants in the natural environment and they're harmful to people. So, and then all the building materials back then had asbestos, a lot of, you know, everything had lead paint on it that flaked off into the soil and essentially contaminated the soil. So the Bureau came back and said, well, we're really comfortable more with like a number of around 1,500 acres. And that is kind of the number that stuck the whole time while the tribe was negotiating for this. And the tribe actually, you know, they pursued this administrative transfer with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And then at the same time, they were also pursuing a congressional transfer with their, you know, the local politicians. And in this case, it was Senator Tammy Baldwin. So Baldwin, there were a lot of talks for many years, and then finally in 2014, Senator Baldwin tacked this transfer of 1,552 acres, roughly, onto the National Defense Authorization. Many of you probably know that the National Defense Authorization Act, if you ever read it, probably haven't. I had never read it until this property transfer, but people stick everything under the sun on there because they know it's going to get passed. I mean, it's the defense of the United States, so it's going to get passed sometime. It's just a matter of when. So she managed to get that tacked onto that act, and then that passed, went into law Some say it's for free, but so it did transfer directly from the Department of Army to the Department of Interior at no cost, but the transfer process went essentially from 87, well, I mean, it was serious discussions probably from 95 or so to 2014. A lot of attorney fees, although the tribe has their own attorneys, a whole department of them. Obviously, you're paying them, very expensive, going back and forth to meetings. I mean, literally millions of dollars spent just on the negotiation stuff. And then we've been going, you know, and then it kind of was handed over like, okay, start managing the land. And now we're at the point of dealing with Army infrastructure that was left that they didn't remove because they weren't legally required to. You know, if it wasn't an environmental liability, the Army didn't take it out. They left it here. So we've been dealing with a lot of that stuff, and that's things like old utility lines, water lines. There was actually like 30 miles of railroad track that ran through the tribe's portion. Of course, the Army came in and took the iron rails because they could get paid for that metal, but they left all the railroad ties. And when we run prescribed fire through here as a management technique, all those railroad ties want to start on fire because they're full of creosote. So that was one of our big projects actually last spring, where we removed, we have about half the ties removed from the property, and it was 406 tons at removed, and it actually had to go to a landfill because there's nowhere else to take it. We actually tried to recycle them and grind them into fuel for the incinerator in La Crosse, which one could argue isn't a great way to dispose of them either, but in my opinion, that's probably better than landfilling them. But the incinerator wouldn't take them because some of them had metal spikes in them and railroad plates on them, so they couldn't run them through their grinders because it would screw it up. So we've been dealing with all that, and that's all expensive work. You know, the railroad tie disposal was $38,000 just to get rid of the ties, and then all of our labor wasn't even included. So, are there any other questions?
You may have alluded to this already, but did the land come with any funds for this type of work? The cleanup and restoration?
So, before I get into the restoration, I can kind of talk about how it's funded. So the cleanup work that we're doing, like getting rid of this unwanted infrastructure and invasive management work and prairie restoration that we are actively doing, that is getting funded from different sources. And one thing that we did right away, which was great, is we do have some leases out on this parcel. So, and I'll talk more about why there's a cornfield here, because that doesn't seem like it should be there. But so we have that as a lease. There's a research and development company in the northwest corner that actually designs rocket motors, that, you know, stuff that they launch satellites into space and the space, International Space Station stuff. They do research up there, and they lease a facility from the tribe. All that money goes into a restricted account that's put back into this property. So pretty lucrative leases, and that all goes into a management account that pays for cleanup, it pays for invasives management or anything else, education. You know, we'll have groups out here and just pay to, you know, transportation, things like that. The other source of our work, our funding, is grants from primarily Bureau of Indian Affairs. So I write different grants for invasives management, restoration work. We've been really successful in getting those funds, and that's funding primarily all of our invasives work right now. Some of our prairie restoration work is actually funded by USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. So since about 2002, the tribe's been using what they call Environmental Quality Incentives Program funding. That's a contract that a producer, or in this case, the tribe, can enter into with USDA, and it provides cost share funds to install a conservation practice that is fixing a resource concern on the parcel that you've identified. case we want to install, or say we want to manage invasive species, the resource concern is that these invasive species are taking over the landscape and they're crowding out all the native vegetation, which in turn is causing the grassland birds that historically were here to move on to different areas or potentially not even be able to survive here. So for prairie restoration, same thing. There's a lack of wildlife habitat. The resource concern is lack of wildlife habitat for the grassland birds that are here. We're installing native prairie and wildflowers to promote grassland birds, pollinators, monarch butterflies, you name it. So small mammals that might be here. So that's pretty much how it's funded. And the tribe, we actually don't have a budget set up with the tribe, but the tribe is really providing all of the labor out here for the most part. So it's a combination of things.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I talked to David Meyer a couple months ago about the leasing process, and he indicated that that was like a really, really difficult decision, like with the rocket.
Yeah.
Is there a sunset on some of those leases?
Yeah.
And that it was like renegotiating them to be as lucrative as possible.
Right.
With the lowest level of commitment.
Yeah.
Right.
So it is weird that a rocket development company's here. The thing is, they were here in the late 80s, and that's really the only reason that they're here. Like, if they just came to the tribe and approached them saying, yeah, we want to have this facility on your property, the tribe would probably say no. But they were an existing use out here. There's a lot to their lease. So part of their lease is that they're actually using a lot of old infrastructure that was left by the Army. So part of their lease was to knock down old Army buildings, and then they built their new structures on those existing slabs. So knocking down those Army buildings included abating the asbestos that was in them. So those are all things the tribe didn't want. Those buildings, that's all stuff we have to do anyways. Well, they're taking care of it for us. The other thing is their facility now has been, they've improved it, remodeled it, and it's state of the art now. So prior to this, they were testing rockets, and nothing bad ever happened, but there probably weren't the safety measures in place that needed to be in place. So now their compound is actually chain link fenced off, which doesn't look the greatest, but it's safe. They have, cameras that can monitor everything on their site, so they can make sure that someone's not trying to climb over the fence and break in and cause trouble. They really had no stormwater management prior. Now they have stormwater management engineering controls built into their design. They really had no noise abatement before. So they test these rockets. You can imagine they're pretty loud. They're not, and by the way, they're not shooting anything up into the air. These are rocket motors about this big around that sit in a metal stand, and then they have sensors all connected to them, and then they basically shoot a, you'll see the tail of the flame coming out the back, but they're still loud, so they have noise abatement now that they never had before. So it's actually quieter than it was before. Some of the cool things that they're doing is we went into this knowing that we need to get tribal youth involved in STEM programs. So part of their lease agreement is where they're coming into classrooms and providing, giving lectures to kids, trying to get them interested in STEM careers. They're helping kids with, if they're college students, they'll help them with their resumes. They'll do mock interviews with them to kind of bring them up to speed. There's internship opportunities. There's stipends for space camp. I mean, just some really cool stuff that we wouldn't have access to otherwise. So those are all really factors that weighed into the decision.
Did the, I guess two related questions. Did the land transfer to the Ho-Chunk or to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I guess, for the Ho-Chunk happen at the same time as the land transfer to USDA and
no,
DNR?
So it didn't, it all was a staggered transfer. So Research Center Farm was built in the late 70s. And the Army was letting USDA crop and use these fields in this area for ag research for a long time, essentially free of charge, because it was another federal agency. So there wasn't a lot of, when it came time to transfer the parcel, there really was no argument from the tribe or from the DNR that, you know, USDA should get those lands. Everybody was fine with that. So that transferred first, and then some land transferred to the Wisconsin DNR, and then the Ho-Chunk transferred in 14, and then the remainder transferred to the DNR a little bit. And then what's left out here is there's actually two cemeteries that were in cemeteries prior to Army ownership. You know, they're white settler cemeteries from the farm families around here. Those didn't transfer to anyone. They were supposed to go to the township, but that never happened, and now whoever will take them. The town is reluctant because of the management that they'd have to do on them. You know, all the towns, probably everywhere in Wisconsin, they don't have a lot of money, so they don't want to take something on that they didn't have before. The tribe is considered taking the cemetery, which we'll actually go up there later, but we've considered taking that cemetery because the tribe has a shortage of burial plots. And there's a lot of open spaces in that cemetery, but there's some reluctance to take it just because of the management and other reasons. Some tribal members have expressed that they don't want to be buried in a white person's cemetery, which I understand. And others don't care, so it's just kind of sitting there not being transferred. Mm. The other cemetery is actually surrounded by Wisconsin DNR. Mm.
And are the different parcels managed really independently, or do the
they are
together?
Yeah, so there's another facet to this whole transfer discussion. There was actually what's called a Badger Reuse Committee was established. So that was, I think, 23 different entities sat on that committee. And they really formulated what they wanted the end result to look like out here. So what's the long-term plan for this entire parcel as a whole? And it really came down to being sustainable ag because of USDA, natural resource or habitat restoration, environmental education, and recreation, but it had to be low impact recreation. So that committee report, they came out with a report that was approved and signed off by everyone, and that also called for this property to ideally be managed as a whole by all the landowners. The report was, you know, it was a committee report. It didn't have any, there was no legal requirement to follow it. And I would say now that all the land is transferred, we do work together, but there's always room for improvement. It's not as seamless as it is in like the Kickapoo, where the tribe and the state really work hand in hand on land management. Here it's really, and it's getting better. At this point, we're really, I mean, we interact with each other all the time and we let each other know what we're doing, but we're still, you know, my money is my money, your money is your money. I have more money than you do, so I'm doing more work. And I wish I could give you my money, but I can't because it's state land kind of thing. So we're working through it, but it's, as I said, it's getting better, and I expect in the future that it's really going to be managed as a whole, especially as things start, as the habitat starts to get restored. We're already having a lot of discussions about what species of prairie do we put here. Is it tall grass prairie? Is it short grass? Is it dry, dry prairie? Is it wet prairie? What birds are using that? You know, what barriers are in place that prevent birds from coming from DNR land to Ho-Chunk land and vice versa and things like that. So.
Did the Dairy Forage Research Unit clean up their land from the contaminants?
So the Army is the agency that's still responsible for cleaning up any contamination that's out here. As far as the dairy forage, like when they eventually, when they site their farm out here, assuming it does get built, they're going to actually remediate. close their manure pits, excavate them, make sure there isn't any contamination there, tear the buildings down, and that land may in fact transfer to one of the other partners out here, whether it be DNR or the Ho-Chunk people, so. But they plan to abandon that existing farm at some point.
Question, so what level of cleanup happens, right, because this isn't land that's being used for human habitation?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a lower cleanup standard, I understand. Mm-hmm. Like, how does that affect, like, the possibility of, like, collecting medicines and foods,
sure,
you know, down
mm-hmm.
the line?
Yeah, so I can talk 5-10 minutes about cleanup. So all the cleanup is, the responsibility is still on the Army, you know, by law. So they started remediating sites out here back in, I want to say like late 90s is when they started. So they did a big baseline investigation that is essentially what they would call a phase one site assessment. So that involves doing all the literature search of all the documents that would have been retained on this property, interviews of people that worked out here or were contractors out here, and they're just documenting what actually happened out here, what chemical compounds did they use in the process, where did you dump your waste, what building materials did you have out here, what herbicide did you spray on the roads to keep the weeds down? Did you spread oil on the roads to keep the dust down? The whole gamut. And then, so they identified all these different sites out here on the entire parcel, several sites on Ho-Chunk land. A lot of the sites on Ho-Chunk land were actually more related to building materials, so the lead paint, sometimes the paint had PCBs in it, you know, lead flooring, so they used acid out here in the production process, so they had to have lead floors so the acid wouldn't eat through the concrete and stuff, so those are all sources, but they also had a lot of above ground storage tanks, and they had underground storage tanks that had diesel fuel, heating oil, and things like that. Like any gas station back in the day, those tanks all eventually leaked at some point. So a lot of the cleanup on tribal land was cleaning up those types of sites. Every time they tore down a building out here, they would go in, sample around it, determine what contaminants were there or not there. If they did find something, they pretty much all had lead in the lead paint. So they would literally take the building down, scrape the soil up, you know, to a certain depth, retest all the soil around the building, make sure they got it all, and then declare it clean at some point. There's still some groundwater, there's still some pretty major groundwater contamination in different groundwater plumes out here. Luckily, the major plumes are not on the tribe's land. They're actually south and northeast, all down gradient, so groundwater here is basically flowing south and east towards the Wisconsin River. So the plumes that are out here, two of them are associated with areas where if the product they were making, whether it be powder or propellant or paste that went in those rockets, if it didn't meet the spec, the Army would try and rework it because they didn't want to waste anything because it's expensive and waste people's time. So they would try and rework the recipe to make it work. But if it didn't, they had two sites that they actually hauled this stuff out to and would burn it to try and get rid of it. Because back then, you got to think this is the 40s all the way up until the 70s. There was really no environmental regulation whatsoever in the U.S. I mean, that all came in the early 70s with the Clean Water Act and then the Clean Air Act. So they would burn this stuff, and of course it got into the soil, and then it rained and it washed it down into the groundwater table. So those are two major sites that they've actually done remediation on, excavated what they felt they could, but there's still contamination at depth. That continues to be monitored, and it'll probably be monitored for the next, well, in perpetuity, to be honest, until they can prove that it's not going to be a threat to human health. So right now, those plumes unfortunately travel off of the badger property, and the first receptors are residential homes along the Wisconsin River over here. So all that contaminated groundwater wants to go to the river. That's a natural thing. And these homes are kind of the right in between. So they do have monitoring wells all through that area. They do test the homeowner wells on a regular basis for contaminants. And occasionally they do find a well that's contaminated. And if they do, they replace that well. And in order to make sure that it's safe, they actually drill that well down to the bedrock aquifer. It's cased all the way down to the bedrock, and then they grout seal it around so that actually no water from those upper aquifers can get into that well. So it ends up being a very deep well, and it's a very expensive well. So like 300 feet down, the contamination out here is typically about 100 feet when you detect it in the groundwater. So it's ongoing. At one point, there was discussions about to assure that there was no pathway to human health. They were talking about putting in a community water system. So they were going to drill this community well like any city or town would have, upgradient in an area they know is safe, and then connect all the homes to it. Everybody was very excited about that because it would guarantee that they had clean water. Instead of the scenario now is, well, they test every, you know, whether it's quarterly or semi-annually, and then maybe this is the time my well comes back contaminated. So, but then the Army came back, basically backpedaled on it and said they did not have the authority to install a community water system under statute. And that's debatable as whether that is true or not. And so right now they're actually working on a feasibility study long term to figure out what they're going to do out here. My expectation is that they're probably just going to continue monitoring in perpetuity until they can prove that natural attenuation has brought those levels down below any, you know, enforcement standard or preventative action limit is the terms they use. They'll probably do some more remediation in certain spots where it's reasonable and practicable to do that. So if there are some spots where they could excavate a little deeper and it's not going to require a hole that's, you know, you got to think when you dig down 100 feet, they have to terrace that pit to get that deep. So even though the contamination could be 100 yards across in an area, that pit that they got to dig to get to it is literally like a quarter mile across, and it's huge issues. So as far as the Ho-Chunk's use of the land, so their plan out here is to use this property for, first and foremost, maintain its cultural integrity. Even though it was an ammunition plant, this place is still as important as it ever was to the Ho-Chunk people. They also want to be able to provide opportunities like this, so environmental education, cultural education, and lastly, the goal is to restore about 1,000 acres to tall grass prairie, which was what was historically here, and then some wetland restoration and stream restoration on the north side. Those uses, for the most part, are not affected by contamination that's 100 feet under the ground. And you also have to consider that there's one small area that we even detect groundwater contamination that's behind us. So it's a very small area. The other areas that had issues, those have all been remediated. So although it could affect gathering out here, it's probably, you know, it's hard for me to tell the tribe that, but it's probably not going to affect. But there's always that word probably, you know. You can't guarantee 100% that there isn't potential to gather something out here that could have some contamination in it. actually done some research and collected samples out here of both soil and plants. And out of all those samples we collected, none of them had any contaminants. None of the plants had basically any contaminants above what you would normally expect just in the natural environment. And there was only 3 soil samples that had levels slightly above background, but they were well below any standard out here. So, and that was just that's a scattered board of, it was a random sampling approach. So we just went out and collected samples in a grid randomly, and it's just background information. Major thickets like that. I mean, it wasn't solid, but pretty much along all these roadways had invasive brush. And a lot of our effort since 2014 has been to really remove that brush and get it under control and get it to a point where we can do large-scale landscape management out here with prescribed fire. So when we came in, the problem with those big brush thickets, other than that they're invasive, is that when you go to manage them, you can't run fire through them because fire won't carry. They're big specimens, as big as this. They're so dense that there's no grass layer underneath, so there's nothing to carry fire through there because there's no grass. And the plants themselves are, they're high moisture, so they're not going to catch fire even though they're wood. Even if you throw diesel fuel on them, they're going to burn for a little bit until the fuel is gone, and then they're going to burn out. So what we've done in the first basically 2 years of having this property is come in with what's called a FECON forestry mower. And this is something that's about, it's a 5-foot wide mower that's on a track loader, and it's really like a stump grinder. It can go through and it can literally, it's like mowing the lawn through a patch of brush. It'll just grind that stuff up. And we've done that on basically the entire 1,000 acres of this open area. And then what we hope is the grass gets established in those areas, and then we can run fire through there. And what fire does is, as long as those invasive brush specimens, as long as they're like about the size of your thumb or smaller, the diameter of a quarter or so, fire will run through there and top kill it. It won't kill the plant entirely. The roots will still be there, but it'll kill anything that's above ground. As long as you can run fire through there and top kill that stuff periodically so that it doesn't get to be these huge trunks of invasive brush, we're happy with that because we can keep it under control. We can keep it from spreading. The grassland birds love it because it's more grass cover and less brush, although there are a whole list of birds that like that brushy habitat. So what we do is try and manage a continuum of different habitat types. The other thing we do is we do use herbicide out here. So we spot treat individual plants with herbicide. And right now we're just strictly treating invasive brush. We don't even worry about, most of the stuff you see out here is not what we want as far as vegetation. It's a lot of cool season grass, invasive species. There's spotted knapweed, there's wild parsnip, Queen Anne's lace. Those are all weeds that we don't want. But grassland birds that are still here, and I should back up a little bit. So the Army, this was farmland that was first it was Ho-Chunk, then it became farmland that was always in a grass cover because they grew oats, barley, wheat, or whatever. That's a grass habitat that grassland birds can survive in. Plus, they always had these large areas that they didn't have anything growing for ag crops. So weedy fence lines and everything still supported these grassland birds. Then the army came in. They had all these buildings out here, but yet there was still this huge expanse of grassland that the grassland birds could survive in. And the weird thing about all this is that the ammunition plant being here essentially saved these populations of grassland birds, because if the plant didn't come in, it would all got converted to corn and beans or residential subdivisions like everything else south of here, towards Sauk Prairie and Sauk City. So, but getting back to the stuff that's out here, so the grassland birds are here. They don't necessarily care that it's invasive weeds and cool season grasses that we don't want out here. They're still surviving. But what we're doing is getting this invasive brush under control, and then we're slowly converting stuff back to native species. So in this northeast corner where these yellow flowers are, there's 130 acres there that was planted to pollinator habitat last fall. So it's about a mix of about 40 wildflowers and legumes, and then a couple of grass, native grass species. And we've been managing that this summer with mowing until it gets well established. If you look to the kind of here where the corn is, the reason there's corn there is that we're using row crop eggs as a weed management tool. So we have a local farmer lease the land. We get lease payments from him that go into the account for the property that's used for management. He is doing what what the typical farmers in this area do. He applies herbicide to control his weeds. He'll do that for us for a period of 5 years. And then after 5 years, that last year he leaves it in soybean stubble after he harvests. And then we come in with a no-till prairie drill and we'll directly seed our prairie into that soybean stubble. And that's actually what we did on this 130 acres here. That was a 3-year lease with 2 years of corn, 1 year of beans, and then we planted it to prairie. So there's about 100 acres here getting prepped right now for prairie restoration, and it'll be, well, 4 years from now since we've been in it a year. So
is that a typical practice?
That's very normal, yeah.
To do that?
It's
row crop into prairie?
Yep, it's very successful because you get all that weed treatment for, you know, for a period of time. We've done it a lot where we'll take a fallow field like this and we'll burn it to remove all the biomass that's on it, and then we may spray it two or three times during the summer and then try and plant it in the fall. But there's so much seed bank there of weed seeds that, I mean, it'll look totally dead when you plant it, but the next year there's weeds everywhere. So in the scenario when you're using row crop, you're getting multiple weed treatments for multiple years, so it's a lot more successful. Plus, you have a really nice planting base with the soybean stubble. It's like ideal for doing that. So we try not to use herbicide on the property. We use as little as possible, but I always tell people, it's not an ideal situation, but it's also just a temporary thing that we're doing, and then we're restoring it to a permanent cover where we'll probably not use herbicide again unless there's an occasional invasive species that we can't either mow or pull out by hand. So what was that? Sure, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we can walk out
like
in the prairie planting if you want to, and it's been